Well, good evening, everyone. So I think we all know each other a little bit. So Angie asked me to sit in and for her and say a word or two about the text we're studying. She said the words we're letting sink into us or roll through us somehow. The Vimalakirti Sutra. Not everyone has it. Maybe you could check it out from the library or something. It's such a classic that it's pretty readily available. This is kind of the one we're looking at this time by Burton Watson translation, but there's also Robert Thurman translation, which I have from a while ago, and that's what Angie passed out. For those of you who were here last week, she passed out the introduction to that, and I hope you had a chance to read some of that. I'm going to reference it a little bit later. So this chapter we're on is chapter 3, and this is a real debating tour de force. Vimalakirti just sort of creams all of the guys who show up and who try to have a discussion with him. The Buddha actually asks his disciples, his direct disciples, to go and check on Vimalakirti and to see how ill he is, and then bring back word from the Buddha. But one by one they go, everyone from Shariputra to Manjushri, and here's the next one that he does. It's a really fun name, Magadaliyana Yana. So he has about 12 disciples go through, and they each reply to the Buddha, "Well, I'm not competent to visit him, and here's why." And they each have a different reason, because in these encounters they've each had with Vimalakirti before, he brings up some points to them that tells them why they don't really understand things. So this basically what he's saying to all of them, and they each have different circumstances, and it's quite a long chapter. I'm not going to into all of those, but the basic thing he's saying to all of them who come to him have encountered him before in different ways, is that there's a way you're holding on to your understanding of the Dharma and of practice. And so the whole overview of the chapter, you could say, is that it's about holding on to whatever we think is the essential thing about practice. And each of these disciples of the Buddha has a kind of a specialty that he is, that he's particularly good at. Some are good at alms, some are good at alms rounds, and some are good at debating, some are good at, you know, understanding the Dharma, quote, unquote. But he's addressing this tendency that we all have as human beings to hold on to things, really to hold on to everything, because that's built into us, it seems hardwired, but especially to hold on to ideas about things, and even very specifically, which I'll quote, I will read some of it and quote some of it, which struck me as particularly something maybe that's good to remember. We have a tendency to hold on to things, material things, but particularly ideas, and that's what gets us in the most trouble as a species, is holding on to ideas. We have that capacity to make ideas, to create ideas out of, as all the teachers say, out of what? Out of thin air. Nobody knows where these ideas come from. They're out there, they're out in our world, and we pick up them on them, and sometimes we alter them, and we're very smarter, or think we are, and we think, oh, I have a take on that, and often we just hold on to the views that are kind of what it's a term in kind of ordinary parlance, the received wisdom. We just hold on to ideas that are sort of out there, that everybody knows. But of course, all those ideas change, and therefore it's not really helpful for us to hold on to those. And Vimalakirti goes into great detail to explain this in each particular context with each particular person, each disciple that he's met. And they all say, well, at a certain point, they say, and this is what he said to me. They're talking, they've come back and said to the Buddha, said, no, I can't do it. I can't ask after him because I don't know what I would say to him. I have nothing to say. Some there's a little edge. He put me in my place so much, but others, just like I realized what I didn't know before, and I'm very grateful to him, but I don't feel that I'm worthy. Competent is one word that Burton translates, or worthy. I don't feel like I can really even go and ask Vimalakirti how he's doing. So there's kind of this interesting interplay. It's very much reminiscent of the way that the Buddha taught in the early suttas, which are called suttas in the Pali, not sutras. But he was always running into characters that were part of his life, were part of the life of his times, that were debating him and saying, well, if we don't do rituals, then what's the point of even practicing, or what is this dharma? I mean, so the Buddha was having these discussions in very early Buddhism, as well as in this later time of around the third or the fifth century Common Era, when the Vimalakirti Sutta was, at least where we have a record of it. So I'm reminded when I read this chapter particularly of the Metta Sutta, which we chant in here on the day longs and half days and in Sashin, that ends with it's a sutta about compassion and great friendliness to all beings, no matter what their place or state. But it ends with not holding to fixed views, endowed with insight, freed of sense desires, one who achieves the way is freed from the dualities of birth and death. And Vimalakirti talks in this chapter a lot about duality, a lot about duality. So I'll read you a little something from one of these Magda, it's a tongue twister for me, Magdala Gyana. He says, so why I was talking to people, I am not competent to visit and inquire about his illness. Why? Because in the past I entered the great city of Vaishali, where he Vimalakirti was, and in its streets and lanes expounded the Dharma for the lay believers, and Vimalakirti's a layman. At that time, Vimalakirti approached me and said, when you expound the Dharma, you should not expound it in the way you're doing. Expounding the Dharma should be done in accordance with the Dharma reality itself. And then he has quite a long exposition on how that should be done. And some of the highlights are, the Dharma is without names or appellations because it is cut off from all language. The Dharma is without any expounding because it is removed from broad or minute contemplation by the mind. The Dharma is not the subject of frivolous theories because in the end it is empty. The Dharma is without the concept of mind because it is removed from all such concepts of personal possessions. And then he keeps on. He's really letting Magdalena have it. You know? The Dharma is without coming or going, since it never abides anywhere to begin with. The Dharma transcends the six senses, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. It knows no high or low. It constantly abides, and it's separated from all meditational practices. And then Magdalena says, when Vimalakirti expounded the Dhamma in this way, 800 lay believers set their minds on the attainment of Anuttara Samyuksambodhi for complete perfect enlightenment. And I possess no such eloquence as this. This is why I am not competent to visit him. So there are many, many of these disciples who have their reasons, and they have their encounters. And Vimalakirti in this chapter pretty much covers all the arguments of how you can and try and refutes and is witnessed by the disciples as refuting how you can hold on to, how it's impossible to hold on to any idea or language about the Dharma. Basically what you can say, it is thus. It is. That's what it is. So the language parts are especially interesting, and that's where I think Robert Thurman has a nice explanation of that. But first I'll read another one from another way Vimalakirti talks about the Dharma being without words. He talks also about the Dharma. You eat in a certain way. It's not the way that you eat or not the alms around you go on, but how you hold what you're doing. So he said, because all words and pronouncements too are the same as these other phantom forms. When a person is wise, he does not cling to words, and hence is not afraid of them. Why? Because words are something apart from self-nature. Words do not really exist. And this is emancipation. Or, in other words, this is another way to translate that word. This is liberation. That's what Thurman tends to use. This is liberation. All things of the phenomenal world bear this mark of emancipation. So not clinging to the words or not clinging to the ideas about how things should or should not be done, not clinging to the rites, the rituals, the forms, is what his real message is throughout here. So he's pointing again and again throughout this chapter of the power of language to kind of seduce us, that we somehow think because we have a word for it, it's a real thing, and that it's a true thing. I'm speaking generally, I think all of us do, but humans do that because of our amazing power of language. So the words are fine, but the clinging to them is what's the problem. So in a more, not in the sutra, but in a more kind of professorial way, which Robert Thurman is, he's a professor, he says this. Now we may appreciate, and he leads up to this, but in this paragraph that I'm pulling out, he said, we may appreciate now the first implication of the statement that the immediate relative reality is the ultimate perfect reality. This is the world we live in. This is what it is. This is not something out there. It's not something transcendent, that enlightenment isn't something we attain to. That's something we're embedded in. We just have to kind of clear ourselves out of believing these concepts and these words, these ideas we have about it. Of course, that's not necessarily easy, but if this is so, our immediate reality is ultimate. It cannot be escaped or negated and must be accepted as it is, at least to start, before we try to do something with it in a relative way, and with no false hope of ever making it ultimate. Since being conscious of its ultimacy in the real relative world we live in, on the one hand, and on the other hand, of devoting our energies to improvement of the unavoidable relative situation as best we can. So because the unavoidable relative situations are often things we need to improve. For the successful accomplishment of this dual task, we need wisdom and great compassion, where these functions are the essence of the middle way. Wisdom does not allow us to settle for our habitual involvement with sensory objects, with this floor and this chair and this book, as being given, as out there. We create them. Angie's talked about this in here. You know, we are a relationship with the world, and our sensory apparatuses make a meaning of it. In that sense, we create them. That's not to deny that they don't have a materiality, but we create them and then assign language to them. And wisdom does not allow us to settle for habitual involvement and causes us to learn and practice probing beneath the surface of apparent reality to gain direct awareness of the ultimate reality of things, which, as he's just said, is just where we are, as hard as that is to believe. At the same time, great compassion does not allow us to set up any ultimate reality, immerse ourselves in any quietistic sort of trance or any illogical escapism from relativity, but compels us to act selflessly, even when we do not yet feel enlightened. To act selflessly as if we were enlightened, even if we don't feel enlightened. I wanted to read a little more from Vimalakirti here. This is now he's talking to Upali. And so this kind of follows on what Robert Thurman was saying on page 47, the talk at the bottom, talking to Upali, but in Vimalakirti's words through the translator. Upali, all phenomena are born and pass into extinction, never enduring like phantoms, like lightning. They do not wait for one another or linger for an instant. All phenomena are the product of deluded vision, like dreams, like flames, like the moon in the water, or an image in a mirror, born of deluded thoughts. One who understands this is called a keeper of the precepts. One who understands this is called well liberated. So that's where we get down to where the metal hits the rubber hits the road, or the metal hits the road, or you know, the metal hits our minds, like, because things are so tough, it's like banging up against it. How do we do this? How do we live in this world with the liquid when we're living in as if we were enlightened and everything's the ultimate reality? Well, there's some helps for us, and that is keeping the precepts is one of the major ones, and we practice that a lot in Zen. There are other ones too. There are the paramis and the paramitas. There are very many skillful means, upaya. But keeping the precepts is one way that we can really connect with that, what to do in difficult situations. But as Vimalakirti discusses in here with another disciple, I mean, even keeping the precepts, if you have such an idea that your way is the right way, and the way you're keeping the precepts is, yes, this is a real precept way, then there's a kind of a self-delusion in that too. And not only self-delusion, but a real creation of the self. And it can be a subtle or not. Sometimes it's quite obvious, people who think they're doing things the right way, whether it's in Zen or anywhere else. Like, I'm doing it the right way. And it's, you know, they're kind of, as we used to say in grade school, stuck up. You know, kind of, they think they know better than other people. So there's that. So we're kind of always to really accept this path and enjoy it. From my view, we're always kind of on a tightrope, and that may feel uncomfortable, but at first. But after a while, it just feels like you're walking the tightrope, and there's no danger in falling. If you fall off, you just pick up and get yourself back on again. But if you go to one side or the other side too much, you're gonna fall off by holding on to something. When you're on a tightrope, you could hold on to your stick for a while, but you can even let that go at a certain point. And ultimately, that comes down to trust. It comes down to trusting in the Dharma and trusting in ourselves. And that's what the Buddha said. He said, no matter where you are in this way, you can always and always will go along further. And you can always see things you haven't seen before. That's part of the vitality of this path, part of the beauty of it. It's alive. As long as you keep, another phrase that's common, as long as you keep an open mind, maybe that's just all we need to remember. Just keep an open mind. The Buddha said, Ehi Pasiko, in the Pali, he said, go and see for yourself. Just go and see for yourself. And the very last thing he said about, that's kind of trusting yourself in a way. See for yourself, and then trust yourself what you see. The very last thing he said in the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, when he was passing away, he was actually dying, and his disciples were gathered around, and he gave a long, well, not so long, but he gave a little talk to them, discourse, and then at the very end he said, the last words were, continue on with care. Continue on with care, a lamp unto yourselves. Because they were asking him, well, what are we going to do when you're gone? What are we going to do when there's no teacher to tell us what to do? Not that that was really the situation anyway, because they figured out a lot of things to do themselves. But we all... we love our elders. We grew up we grew up as human beings who have elders. And we need teachers and wouldn't develop as human beings unless we had them from the time we were born. So it's another hard thing to let go of your teacher. But continue on with care. and be a lamp unto yourselves. So I think I've said enough, and I hope we have some time for questions or discussion, comments, or whatever's up. Karen? It's okay.
Well, one thing that struck me just lately, the last thing that I've said is about having trust and you know, our elders and our teachers is partly how we form the trust and or the faith in the practices by having these teachers and this, you know, just this interaction. And then another thing, a couple things. Very thought-provoking talk today. But wondered if this is that saying, if you meet the Buddha on the road, then kill him.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of the concept of what you're saying about fixed ideas, and if you think you've got it with your strong dharma approach or strong whatever this was, how he's kind of showing them the holes in their grasping of the fact that they think they know exactly the way. Wondered if that was sort of related to that statement that
it could be. That's actually from a poem, which I can't remember exactly the way it goes now, but that is the line from a Japanese poet, I think 18th century. Well, the way I interpret that, so this is just my interpretation, is that that poem and that line particularly is like, don't be dazzled by, you know, if you meet the Buddha on the road, instead of falling down and saying, oh, Buddha, you know, like, don't be dazzled by outward appearances. But, you know, really look. And so, in a way, in that sense, for me, it is related to that. Really look and see for yourself. The phantoms, as Vimalakirti talks quite a bit about here, in phantoms, about phantoms, and everything being a phantom and a dream. We can kind of make up our stories at a level which we don't always understand. That's what sitting down allows us to see. Sitting down allows us, we start to get a sense, it's natural to us, if we do sit down, to get a sense of where we're just holding on or reverently bowing down to somebody who's got the answers for us, or you know, where we make mistakes in our life. And sometimes it's not easy to see that, but it's how we can live with compassion, as Robert, compassion for ourselves and compassion for others. Okay. Paul.
Did the Buddha ever take Vimalakirti aside and say, stop being such a bully?
You know, I haven't read it in a while, and certainly in so I don't remember, so it's like, oh, reading a book that you like and getting to read it over again. Mm-hmm. So I don't remember if that happened, but he doesn't, turns to, in the next chapter, he turns to the bodhisattvas and ask them to go see the Buddha. So I think it's going to continue on for a while. But he certainly never just accepts what his disciples say about, oh, they've gotten their fixations kind of made. They've been aware of their fixations because of what Vimalakirti has said. He never refutes Vimalakirti in this chapter, and I think he asks the bodhisattvas also to go, and so I'm just looking forward to seeing how it unfolds, and I don't remember.
Okay. Sounds like he's got all the answers.
There is a twist, as I remember, right? Because now Vimalakirti, but this story, one thing that's interesting about it, there's a lot of shifts, like a Shakespeare play, sure. You know, or any great story. You know, things move in and out. No one's. A major point of the whole story, which I think Angie's talked about, she did in her introduction, is that this is about empowering the lay people, when for so many centuries it was only the monks who held the true Dharma, so to speak. And this is about the lay people have that too. So they get a chance to, through Vimalakirti, to, you know, have their say. Thank you.
Sorry. I just wanted to build on something he said, is that okay?
Sure. Yes.
So it seems like in chapter 2, they talk about expedient means, and I read that as like Vimalakirti sort of could read people and knew what they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so then in chapter 3, he's kind of giving an example, the author is giving an example of expedient means, but with these disciples. So.
Yes, I think he does do that.
And read what they're holding on to and address that directly,
right. So he encounters them in always public places. So he encounters them in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he's talking a lot about, you know, the world, the relative world that we live in. This is the ultimate world. This is the ultimate world. It's no heaven realm, even though everything is all in this beautiful language and these fantastical heaven realms and gods and bodhisattvas and everybody appear. But that's just part of what we do, make up these wonderful stories. So, here you go.
Yeah, thank you. To build on what Blit said, I found the Thurman introduction very interesting. It really enhanced my understanding of what I had read to that point. He says something in here where I have some notes on the back here, that the Buddha teaches the Dharma according to the tolerance of the disciples. So it's always translated into the terms that the listener is going to want to hear, which seems to build up on
mm-hmm.
that. But you said something about being stuck up. And there was something really interesting in here. I don't remember the context. I could find it, but it would take too long. But self-defeating selfishness. And I have to reconstruct my notes. I'm sorry. But it's one of those terms I keep coming across, selfishness. That seems to be a question of the translation might be different, or could possibly be translated differently. Because selfishness, in the way it's normally used, just sort of sounds very grabby, which is of course not something one wants to be. So, but it seems to refer to something that's more like self, like that would be more self-centric,
mm-hmm.
where self-centered, but then self-centered sounds like, oh, he's so self-centered, and that gets back to being stuck up. And it makes it sound like a character flaw that people are selfish, whereas in fact it seems like it's more about, as I've been reading these words, that we're more concerned about holding on to a sense of the self that has been made, that has been reified in some way. And that when I come across the word selfish, I've been translating it into a sense of that you want to let go of a reified self, like holding on to something that may no longer be true, or that doesn't always apply, so it gets back to relativity. I'm not really sure, I'm just babbling here. frequently when I'm reading these things, I'm coming across a word that I think, well, is that quite the word that it would be translated into, were it being translated again? from the original. And that, what's his name, Thurman, starts off right away explaining how void doesn't mean nothingness. And he uses the word void, whereas in the Burton translation, he uses the word empty and emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
And emptiness also sounds like a word that perhaps can be over-relied on, because empty so powerfully means nothing that it's not what it really means.
In English,
yeah.
But it's, well...
And it kind of skews your interpretation of what's being said.
Well, I think the thing to remember is what Vimalakirti said. You know, all the words don't mean anything. That's what he said to Apollo. So all this about the translation, that's like the angels on the head of the pin. Yes, translators can, but getting hung up if it means selfish or selfishness or what, I think you're kind of, you know, have some ideas, but see how that, you know, read some different translations and see how it works for you, because it is about what your, how you take it. But all the translations can be an endless discussion for because we live in Babel, right? That's where we live. But not the words are just empty. So we just sit with it and see what, maybe that's it. In fact, that's why a lot of teachers say enough words, and why particularly koan Zen is gestural about words. Come in and...
Mm-hmm.
What's the answer to, you know, this, that there are no words to answer it with? Paradox.
Thank you
for bringing up that big discussion. Well, I think we've time to do a 1 minute sit after announcements, if there are any.
Okay, sure. So I send out an email that if you're interested in reserving a place or requesting a scholarship for Sashin, the deadline's the July 1st. Even if you don't know exactly what date you're intending on going to Sashin, it would just be helpful to know that you'll be there all or part of it. And in a little, almost 2 weeks, January 9th, July 9th, is our full day sit for July. Here from 9 to 4. So you're welcome to come for as long as you like for that.
Okay.
And that's all the announcements I think I have.
Okay, thank you.
1 minute, sir.
Mm-hmm.